Let it be known that I have turned my recorder on. Well, good morning, everybody. I hope everyone's having a great time so far. This young man back here came in here, thought he was going to face. Really, he's just going back to work. We just put him to work. I thought he was only a monkey for a while, and then because he would climb and climb, and everything I started to climb on, he just jumped in there and said, "I'll do that." And he'd climb up there, and then before long, I found out that he was a technical guru. So little did he know, we're looking for technical gurus. All right, well, the name of my breakout session is Understanding Season of Our Joy. What motivates this is a desire to help you all to know what we're doing, why we're doing it, who we are, what is it, why are we here in the first place? That's one of the big questions. Why are we here? Why are we doing what we do? As you can see, we do a somewhat big operation every year. It seems like it grows every year. And so what's the motivation behind that? And why is it that you guys got on our website and for some reason decided to come keep the Festival of Tabernacles with us this year instead of staying at home or whatever? So, well, we're just trying to help you to understand that background and a little bit of biblical basis for what we do, some of the traditions we do, why we're sort of out of the box in a lot of ways. How many of you think we're out of the box in some ways? Okay. All right. Some of you think we're not, so you're more accustomed to this stuff than maybe I am. So anyway, that's the purpose of our breakout session this morning. So real quickly, what are we? First thing is, we are not a church or we're not a denomination. Are we a movement? No. Season of Our Joy is simply a group of people who decided years ago that they wanted to come together and keep the Feast Tabernacles together and offer festival services in a little bit different format than what we had been accustomed to. How many of you read our history on our website? Have ever read our history? Okay, so you know pretty much where we're from. Just real briefly, I came out of a church organization that kept Feast Tabernacles for years and years and years. And it was our tradition to go to some resort, usually on the beach. That's where I always went to because I enjoyed the beach. And I would drag my family down there. They came just kicking and screaming. But no, my kids just loved going down there. And we would go every morning to church service from 10 o'clock till 12 o'clock, and then we were free the rest of the day. And that was it, right? So that's where we did. But when we got into the Hebraic movement, which I did at basically 1996, 1997, we realized that there's more to this Bible than what we'd been taught. And we also realized that one of the best ways to learn the Bible is to come together and learn from each other and from people who are not tied in a box, you might say, because of being part of an organization or maybe being tied to a salary where they can only speak what they were being paid to speak. You know, it's some preachers are that way. You know, they're really tied to what they can say, and if they get outside of that box, they'll, you know, have a good chance of getting terminated. So we wanted to have that ability, and we also wanted to have the ability to hold our speakers accountable. And that was something I think that, at least in my background, was something that was lacking. I don't know about any of you. How many of you came from like Baptist church or Methodist church or Pentecostal and stuff like that? Okay, so most of you are evangelical in some way. So you know how it is, preacher gets up there and gives his talk and then he gets down, right? Well, we think, I was under the impression, or I felt like it was really important for a speaker to be able to answer for what he said in front of everybody. Because at least in what I was doing, if the speaker said something that was obviously not correct, no one would ever call him on it, except maybe a little small crowd of people would go up there and talk to him afterwards. And he would say, "Oh yeah, you know, I misquoted that, or I said something wrong." Well, so he straightened it out with those five, but those 5,000 didn't hear him straighten it out. And so we wanted to avoid that. So anyway, I got a little bit ahead of myself. I apologize. But we're not a movement. There's a, if you've ever been to the Messianic Israel Alliance, Scott Diffendurfer calls what we're a part of is a Hebrew roots awakening. And I think that's a more fitting term for what's going on, because we're waking up to what God wanted his people to understand and know. But he had blinded people for two millennia, and now he's the one who's lifting the scales off people's eyes and opening them up to see these things. So I would like to call this a Hebrew roots awakening that we are part of, and Season of Our Joy is playing a small part in the awakening. So, are we a denomination? No. I have one church. I mean, I have one fellowship that I'm the fellowship leader of. We have about five families in it, and that's it. Of those five families, three of them are up here. Three of the families are here. So we're a very small group. But what we have done over the years is that we started this back in 1999, and as time goes on, people come and they see a value in what we're doing, and so they join themselves to it. First one to do so was Ronald McCowan. He did so back in 2000. He said he would like to help us out, basically because he and I had a common friend who is also the guy that I partnered with in starting this. And that guy got killed in an industrial accident, and so Ron tried to fill in his shoes there, and that's how it came to be. He was just helping me out, and as time went on, I brought him into the decision-making process also. Then Lee Miller came on the scene in 2002. He had called me and said that he would be willing to lead music in 2000, but I didn't have a place for him. 2001 we missed because we couldn't get our facility, and so in 2002 Lee called me and says, "Hey, I'm still here. If you need some help, I'll be glad to help." And so I picked him up and he started helping us there. And as time went on, I gave him responsibility. I own a cabinet shop, and I have about, at one time had 50 people working for me, and I know how to delegate. And so when I see someone who's willing to work and willing to put effort into something, then I'm very easy, I very quickly delegate things to them. There again, this fellow back here can attest to that. I found out he knew a little bit about internet, and so all of a sudden my internet problems were just shifted. So now he's taking care of most of that for us, and so we're really, really proud of it. So that was, Lee came on in 2002. Mark Roth, I met Mark in 2004. He came to the Feast of Tabernacles. His wife had come to visit a little woman's conference down in our area. And his wife came with another woman, Marcy Merritt. Many of you may know Marcy and John Merritt. They've been here a number of years. But she came with them. And so Mark Roth came over to our house to pick up his wife, Linda. And of course, during that two-day conference, my wife talked about this festival that we were doing. And so Linda said, well, she'd like to check it out. So she talked Mark into coming to the feast in 2004 down at Ardmore, where we were at the time. And Mark told her, I'll go, but if it gets weird, I'm leaving. So he came down, and after about 3 days, he came up to me and says, what can I do to help? So you know, that's where we picked up Mark. So as you can see from the history, we're not hiring people, we're not looking for people who are simply, have certain skill levels or something like that. We're just basically saying, if you want to help us out, come help us out. And as you continue to help us out, then, you know, we want to make you a part of the process and you know, just sort of join in the effort. This is our one big thing a year. This is basically it. We do some small conferences in our area down in East Texas throughout the year, but this is our one big thing a year. So we're not a denomination. Lee Miller is a Southern Baptist. Mark Roth is Church of God. I'm Church of God. And Ron is Church of God. But anyone who wants to come help, you know, we're non-denominational thinking. That's just where we came from. We've left all that behind, as I'm sure most of you have left all that behind yourselves. Okay, come. Are we a cult? Yes, we're a cult. You know what a cult is? It's a group of people that think the same way. And so most of us do think the same way. I was a part of a cult, at least in the eyes of many people. It was the Church of God back in 2000, or back in the 80s and 90s when we would go to the feast. A lot of you probably thought we were weird and screwy, and now you're doing it too. So I tell the people in our area, we got a couple families in our area that won't fellowship with us simply because we were part of the Church of God. And even though we all have the same walk, now they think we're sort of still weird. And so, but yet now they're doing what we used to do. So anyway, figure that. Yes?
What kinds of things do we do that they consider weird?
Weird? Go to the Feast Tabernacles, keep the Sabbath. All of that was considered weird. Not eating food. I mean, I went to high school during those years, and everybody thought we were weird. So, okay, why are we doing this? Number one is our desire to learn. When we got into this movement, we wanted to learn from other people who were not restricted, sort of like what I said earlier. And so when Mitchell Smith and I came together and decided we were going to do this, we said that we're going to have a place where anybody can come speak. And that got me in a lot of trouble early on because I would let anybody come in and speak. And it was my thinking, well, I'm going to get ahead of myself here, but we would let anybody come in and speak, and we realized that we had to restrict it some. And so our speaking list is restricted to people that believe that Yeshua is Messiah and that believe that Torah is applicable for the people of God. That's our two requirements. Pretty stringent, I know. But that's all it is. If you fit into those areas, then that's fine. So that's why we've got people like David Wiseman. How many of you know David Wiseman, who you may have bought etrogs from before in the past? Okay, well, David Wiseman claims to be Orthodox Jew, not a believer. He's a great guy. He obviously believes in keeping Torah, but he doesn't believe in Yeshua as Messiah, so I don't let him speak here. But if you fill those two requirements, then you can become a speaker. So that opens it up pretty broad, doesn't it? So there again, it's a very non-denominational thing. But we all have to have a desire to learn, and that's what we thought was important. Then the next thing is accountability. And this is where I come in strong. I had a meeting with my speakers yesterday, and I said, you guys are accountable. We're going to hold you accountable. We want you guys to hold them accountable. If they say something up there that sounds off the wall, that sounds totally wrong, we want you to call them on it. And we want you to call them on it in front of everybody. Because if they make a gross error, then we don't want you guys to go back home thinking that this is what we, from Season of Our Joy, believe. We want someone to call them on it. We want everybody to see that he was called on it. That way, someone out there, someone new to this, and that says, well, I'm new to this, I'm not going to say anything, they're going to hear someone else say, hey, that wasn't right, was it? Or can you explain that a little bit better? Or where did you come up with that? And that way they know, the brand new person who's never been this, or maybe like only 2 or 3 weeks into this movement, and there's someone here that's only 3 weeks in, this is their third Sabbath. They're going to come here and they're going to realize that what this person said is not necessarily what Season of Our Joy or the mainstream, let's call them Hebrew Roots movement, tends to believe. Okay? Especially if someone comes up there like we've had in the past and starts calling, you know, saying, you know, Yeshua is this, Yeshua that, or he's make-believe or something like that. You know, if someone says stuff like that, someone needs to call them on it. And that's the whole purpose of taking questions. Now, we have strict guidelines for those of you who ask questions. We want you to ask questions and not preach. If you want to preach, you have to get hold of me early in spring, and then you can sign up and become a speaker. But otherwise, you know, we just ask you to ask questions, don't make comments. But just do hold everybody accountable. And accountability stands up, is something that goes beyond just the speaking sessions. Accountability is, you know, if you're out here meeting with someone or talking to them personally, you know, I've told all you guys, said, you know, you need to be able to substantiate everything you say in casual contact, you know, with other people and all that. So be accountable. You've got to be accountable because most of us Christianity have never been held, never had to or never felt that we could hold our leaders accountable, right? Okay, so that's what it's all about. We want to hold them accountable. Next thing is personal responsibility. Accountability puts a little bit of personal responsibility on you as an individual. I was told one time when I, about 4 years ago, we had a friend who came up to us and said, "Well, man, you're exposing all these people to all these different views. Don't you feel responsible for them? Aren't you supposed to weed out the wolves and, you know, they're your sheep and all that?" Well, I'm going to tell you right now, folks, you're not my sheep, okay? This is not my flock. We are providing a service for 8 days to be able to bring everybody together here. You have to be accountable to yourselves, and that you have got to be personally responsible for making sure that what these guys are saying are true. And if you don't believe, if you don't think it's true and you can find evidence that's not true, you just trash what they said completely. You have our permission to trash anything anybody says here. So you've got to be accountable for yourself. You've got to study your own scriptures, study the Bible. What Rico said yesterday, you know, is all good stuff. I'm not trying to pick on Rico, but he brought up a lot of new concepts, didn't he? Okay, so it's good for us to go back and start to search those things out before we start teaching those things to somebody else. Make sure that it is absolutely true before, or it's, you know, reasonably enough that we can substantiate, substantiate it before we start passing on to others. So it's a responsibility. You know, you guys aren't my children. I've got 50 children back home that work for me, and I come here to get away from having to deal with children. When I say children, there are people that want to do things, but they don't want to be accountable for them, okay? So you've got to be accountable for yourselves and that you study the things yourselves. We're just here to present the information to you, and then you have to sift it. You've got to be like the Bereans. And what do the Bereans do? I was always told that the Bereans went home to prove that these things were true. But that's not what it says. The Bereans went home to see whether those things were true. And so we're to see if this stuff is actually true that we're being told at this festival. Okay? The next thing is everyone is equal. There again, and I guess when we started Season of Joy, we're somewhat reactive to the way it had been. I remember for many years at the festival having to park out in a parking lot 50 miles away, and it seemed like that sometimes when you're hauling two babies around and strollers and all that stuff, and then other people were just could park right up at the door, and I said, there's something wrong with this picture. And just so happened that I married the sister of a guy who's a minister in our group, and so there was 1 year that we were just, because of where we were at, we had to ride with them, and I just felt really uncomfortable parking right up here in front of everybody, you know. Well, I don't think that's right. And so we are all the same when you come to Season of Our Joy. There are people with different roles and responsibilities, but we're all the same. There's no one above anybody else. There's no one theologically above anybody else. We've got teachers. We've got people like, you know, Joseph Good. These guys have spent years and years and years studying this stuff. We can learn from them, but these guys are not our rabbis. They're not the sages. They're not the ministers. They're just Joes like us, okay? And so we want everybody to treat them just as Joes, okay? Don't lift anybody in the Hebraic movement above anybody else, and especially not above yourself. You should never get to the point where you trust these guys blindly. You should always check them out. There's a scripture that I really appreciate, and it's this. Yeshua says, "But you are not to be called rabbi, for you have one teacher, and the rest of you are all brothers." So, in the eyes of the Messiah, there is one person here, and the rest of us are down here on the floor. And so we should all treat each other that way. And that's not to say be disrespectful to anybody or anything, but just realize that everybody is equal. And so that's the way we are at Season of Our Joy. You know, I'm nobody gets any special privileges. I have to park my car up there on top of the hill if there's no parking spaces down below, just like anybody else would. And so if we drive down there to Conference Center and we park down there in the lower spots just with everybody else. So feel comfortable in that. That's what we want you to do. We want you to realize that you don't hold anybody in real high esteem here, okay? We're just all Joes, okay? So some ask, what's our relationship to Judah? Does this look like a Jewish feast site? Oh, come on, be serious.
Compared to the Baptists,
yeah. Okay. Right. Well, that's right. One of the things is you'll probably not find a Jewish feast site because most Jewish people don't observe the feast, the festival, other than building a sukkah in their backyard. But we have been called the Jewish feast site. We've been called the sacred name feast site. We've been called the lunar Sabbath feast site. We got that name because when we were at Ardmore, there was a group of people that kept the lunar Sabbath. Really great and fine people down in Dallas area, and they would take and come up and they would keep the feast in the campground. They wouldn't come to our meetings, but they would keep it in the campground. They did show up at our hamburger socials and all that stuff, but anyway, they kept it at the campground. But anyway, someone called me one day and said, "Did you know that you're the official feast site for the Lunar Sabbath Association or whatever it's called?" And I said, "No, I didn't." They said, "Go look at their website." So she gave me the website, and she said, "Season of Our Joy, the official feast site for the Lunar Sabbath, whatever it was." So anyway, we've been called that. But we're not the Jewish feast site. I like to call it a Hebrew roots feast site. A fellow came to me yesterday and asked me why we don't call ourselves Messianic Jews. Two things. Number one is I'm not Jewish. And the Messianic term is, I don't think, is a... The Messianic Jewish term to the non-Jewish people, I think, is a term that's sort of not understood correctly. How many of you know a guy named Avi ben Mordecai? Okay. Avi ben Mordecai first used this term one time. He said, "This is the Messiantics organization, or a Messiantics thing." And the reason is because within Messianic Judaism, there's a lot of problems. And of course, there is with every group. But Messianic Judaism, from what I've been able to observe for the last 15 years, is basically people who have switched from Sunday to keeping church on Sabbath, and that's it. And they may keep the festivals or things like that. But for the most part, their way of thinking has really not changed much. And so I don't want to associate with people who have not... take that off the tape. It's not that I don't want to associate. I don't want to be considered a part of a movement that's not really into changing your walk. And so I think the Hebraic term fits better. We are not Jewish, but we are Hebrew. But and I'll get into that here in a segment. But our relationship with Judah is this. We're probably not Jewish. Some of you may be Jewish, but we're probably not Jewish for the most part. I know some of us have Jewish blood, a little blood, Jewish blood. My wife, for instance, does. She found out about this about 15 years ago. But we're probably not Jewish. But we probably are Israelites. Okay, and if you've ever heard a teaching by Dean Wheelock, it's called Abraham's Math. He'll show you the probability that you are not descendant of Abraham is very small. The chances of you not being a descendant of Abraham are very, very small. So you may not be Jewish, but you probably are Israelite. But even if you're not, if you don't even think you're Israelite in bloodline, we have a catch-all phrase here by Paul where he says, if you are Christ, then you're Abraham's offspring and heirs according to the promise. So where does that make you? That makes you an Israelite. Does it make you a spiritual Israelite? No, it makes you an Israelite. This is Paul. Let's read this. It doesn't say if you are Christ, then you are a spiritual Abraham offspring. It doesn't say that, does it? It says, you are Abraham's offspring. So I don't buy this concept of spiritual Israelism. I take the Bible exactly what it says. And if Paul says you are Christ, you're Abraham's seed, I believe that you are Christ, you're Abraham's seed. If God changes your DNA, that's up to him. Okay? But nevertheless, that's where we are in our relationship to Judah. We are then their brothers, right? We are then their brothers. And so as their brothers, we need to honor them as our brothers. That's the way I believe. And so in regards to, you know, dealing with them as far as their food restrictions, various things, we at Season of Joy have tried in the years past, and we still will try to accommodate them. The first 2 or 3 years at the festival, we had some meals together. We called it the Israel family dinner or the Israeli night dinner, where Season of Joy picked up the entire tab for the entire meal, and the entire meal was kosher, rabbinically kosher. And we did that to accommodate our Jewish brothers, so that they could eat with us. We want the tribes to come together as much as possible, not stay separated. And so that's how we feel about the Jewish people. That's how that's why people like Joe Good, who's not Jewish, but he has this close affinity with the Jewish people. That's why we like to have him here every year, because the Jewish people recognize Joe as someone who's not trying to proselyte to them, but truly wants to understand them. And we have a number of people in that regards. So we have this feeling, this close relationship to Judah, not because we're wanting to get blessings. You know, the phrase out there, the Genesis 12 passage where it says, you know, those who bless Israel will be blessed, and those who curse Israel will be cursed. That's saying that those who curse us will be cursed. Right? That's all of us in this room. That's not just the people over there in the land of Israel. And that's not just the Jewish people in New York or the Jewish people in Hollywood. That's us, because we are Abraham's seed. And so those, you know, we need to look at it in that regards. But they are our brothers. The Jewish people are our brothers. We all join into this together. We all have a part in this together. We've got two different jobs to do, but we'll all come together in the end. So that's why we don't oppose Jewish things. That's why we have Jeremiah Greenberg here, who is obviously Jewish, to take and teach us liturgy, because I believe it's important for us to learn the liturgy of the Jewish people, because if we're walking hand in hand with them down the road back to Israel, and they stop in the middle of the day and get on their knees and start singing or praying the Amidah, I think it's important for us to know what the Amidah is. And we'll know what they'll do. And maybe we might want to join in with them. Okay? So that's why we welcome the Jewish understanding and Jewish thoughts in many of these things. We have a covenant relationship with Israel, with God, just as they do. But it's the same covenant that they have, not a new covenant. Do we understand that? What's that? Same covenant that is with Israel. God doesn't have a plan B. He has a plan A. Started with Israel, all 12 tribes of Israel. The covenant made with the Jewish people is the same covenant that was made with us. Okay? And it's still going on. I believe that we can take and learn from Judah. And so we do that. That's why we have some of these traditions like the lulavim. How many of you did that, wave lulavim, in the Christian churches? You didn't ever do that?
I said, of course not.
All right, we never did. Where did we learn that from? We learned that from Judah, right? How many of you ever built a sukkah before you started understanding the Jewishness of your of your roots, you might say. Probably none of you did. Okay, so we're learning things from Judah, and we need to continue, in my view, continue to learn from Judah some of the things that we can help us in our walk. Yes, ma'am. Can I define Israelite? An Israelite is a descendant of Jacob. That's about as simple as it can get.
Versus Jewish.
The Jews are one tribe Jacob had 12 sons. Judah, who were the father of the Jewish people, was one of those tribes. There's 11 more tribes out there that are non-Jewish, but they are Israelites. Yes, sir.
What is a goy?
A goy is a non-Israelite. A goy simply means the nations. That's all it means. In the Bible, I mean, I'm getting into...
Non-Israelite is a goy.
Sir?
Nations.
I'm sorry.
Non-Israelite?
Yeah. Well, see, if you really analyze the Bible, and this is sort of getting theology, and I really don't want to do that in this talk, but if you really look at the Bible is a book about Israel. I mean, everything from the first six chapters of the Bible deals with Israel from that point on. So in biblical terms, there are two different peoples. There's the Israelites, and then there's everybody else. And everybody else is a goy. That's put it in most simple terms. That's the way it is. But see, a lot of people think that the New Testament is about people other than Israel. But as we go on and study that more and more, we realize that the New Testament is all about Israel. I mean, look at the whole book of Romans. What's it about? What does Paul say? The bottom line is all Israel will be saved. He didn't say all goy would be saved. Okay, we can talk about it later. Okay, so we can learn from Judah, and that's what I think is important. That's why we pattern a number of the things we do here based on that. We follow a number of traditions, like waving the lulaving. This is a truly Jewish tradition. There's no biblical substantiation for making this in the Bible. In fact, Ezra says, what does Ezra say to do with the four species?
Build a sukkah.
Actually, Ezra says five. But that's what Ezra says to do. But the Jewish people understand that you are to take the four species, and what are you supposed to do with them? It says you are to take on the first day the fruit of the splendid trees, branches of the palm trees, boughs of leafy trees, and willows of the brook, and you shall rejoice before Yahweh. Okay, so give you a little bit of understanding of Jewish mindset. The Jewish people believe that the five books of Moses are the most sacred words ever written, because they were the only words that were spoken by God to a man, and that man wrote them down. Until, of course, you get to the time of Yeshua. But you notice Yeshua didn't write anything down. He just left it up to his disciples to write things down. But Moses wrote the words that God spoke, put them in a book, and gave them to Joshua. Right? So they look at those things as the most sacred words in the Bible. That's why this passage here in Leviticus carries more weight than the book in Ezra, or than Ezra's words further down the road, basically 1,000 years later. So, that's why they say, how do we take these different things and rejoice with them? Well, they say, we take and put them in our hands and we wave them around. So, and I believe that Yeshua recognized that, because another one of our traditions is the Beit HaShuva, or it's in English, that means house of the water drawing. And that's the tradition. How many of you have not been here before? Ooh, a bunch of you. Okay. We have a tradition here every year. We started this the very first year of doing what we call the water pouring reenactment. It's not a ceremony. It's a first century tradition that we believe that Yeshua followed. And we believe he followed it because he gave it to the Jewish people to set up the stage for him to make one of the most remarkable proclamations of all times. And that God was going to provide a way to save all mankind. And so, in the water pouring ceremony or the water pouring reenactment, what we do is we try to reenact a first century tradition so that we can sort of feel what the people of Israel were doing during the time of Yeshua. It's a very first century custom. Even though it's tradition, practically, in fact, every Jewish tradition has biblical basis. The Jews have a biblical basis for the Beit HaShuva. It's based on misspelling, an intentional misspelling of three words in the book of Numbers. And I wish I had time today to explain it a little bit more, but I'm not going to be able to. Oh, unless I finish up here early, then we can go and look at some of those things. But they base it on that. They see a purpose in doing a celebration during the Feast of Tabernacles based on the use of water, because they see the water as a type of the Holy Spirit. And so that's what it's all about. It's Numbers 26, I think. It's the one that gives all of the different offerings for the Feast of Tabernacles.
Did you give the Bible reference
again? I think it's Numbers 28. Maybe somebody could look that up real quick. There again, I didn't put this together with that intent. I can do that here afterwards, though, if we finish up here. But what we do during the water pouring ceremony or reenactment is that we actually try to create a little mini temple area down there by the Kaler Lodge. And we set up some big flaming lights, torches like they used in the first century temple. We build ourselves a little altar and we go down to a little stream and we gather water out of the stream. And we'll talk about all of this that night. So you'll have a little bit better understanding of what it's all about. But basically what we're doing, in fact, we have gowns that you can wear. You guys, you've been here before. You know what we're doing. You've been here before, yeah. So we have these gowns that you wear, and so you participate. You know, in Hebrew thought, Hebrew is an action language, and so you learn things by doing things. And so we get everybody involved, as many as we can, put their priestly garments on, we call them. And we have someone dress up as a high priest. And we just go through the whole process to try to illustrate to you what they were doing in the first century that led Yeshua to say this. You know, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink, and out of his belly will flow rivers of living water. I didn't put the whole passage up.
But it also connects his ministry to what was going on in the temple.
That's right. That's absolutely right, because what it shows is that Yeshua was fully Jewish. He was fully grounded in the Judaism of his day. And it helps us to understand the value of tradition, helps us to understand the value of the Jewish people and the things that they developed that weren't necessarily spelled out in the Torah. You know, how many of you guys have ever kept the Feast of Tabernacles the way the Torah says to do it? Right. None of us have, right? Okay. What does the Bible tell us to do on the Feast of Tabernacles? To stay in booths and offer sacrifices and enjoy yourself. It doesn't tell you where, it doesn't tell you what to do throughout the day, or it doesn't tell you to go listen to speakers, does it? It doesn't tell you a lot of things that we just do, right? So we're all making things up as we go. But but we're trying to do it in a way that honors Messiah and honors God, obviously. And we're trying to do things in such a way that we can learn about it. And that's one of the beauty of the festivals. You know, you learn about God's salvation through observing the festivals. And there again, I'm getting ahead of myself a little bit. All right. Our goal at Season of Our Joy is to teach the importance of the festivals. Because I believe that it's through the festivals you learn about the plan of salvation for mankind. Because every aspect of the festival teaches another aspect about how God plans to do or bring about the salvation of all mankind. And if you look at what most of us have believed in the past, we would have to say that Hasatan has sort of beat God in the salvation system, you might say. I mean, if there's a search for souls, and if there's a race for the souls of mankind, who's ahead right now? Hasatan, right? Okay. Well, Satan. The deceiver. It means the deceiver.
Okay.
Hasatan. Okay. It's the deceiver. And so the deceiver, he's probably ahead of Yeshua right now, ahead of God in doing these things. But it's not over with yet. And just like Lee brought out yesterday, you know, there's still, from the time of the first century, there's still four festivals yet to come. Because Passover was not the end. And we don't understand that if we're not into the cycle, right? But most churches, most Christian denominations aren't into the cycle. They see Passover, okay, now all things are fulfilled. But those of us who walk Hebraically, we realize that there's four more festivals yet. So it can't be over with Messiah, right? So these festivals teach us the importance and teach us the plan of salvation for God. The importance of the festivals is that to do these things, and by doing these things you learn about the plan of salvation of God. And so we try to do as much of it as we can during the Feast of Tabernacles, especially the things pertaining to this particular part, this particular 8-day festival, actually 7-day festival and one other day. And I put this verse up here, Malachi 3:6, because this is my most favorite of all passages. And it's my favorite because it says, I am Yahweh, I do not change. Therefore you, O children of Jacob, are not consumed. Do you know what that means? Do you ever realize what would happen if God was not an unchangeable God? It would have been over a long time ago. But it's because God says He does not change that we can feel confident that when He says, I will never leave or forsake you, that He will not leave or forsake you. So if He started a good work in you and has put you on a path that's more in tune to His way of thinking than what we've had in the past, then we can rest assured, as long as we'll follow the path, that He will never leave or forsake us. And that, more importantly than even that, is that the ultimate goal of the festivals will come to pass. So I am so glad. That's why I say there's no plan B. That's why God, I believe, did not have to renew the covenant. Because I believe the covenant was always there. It may have been restated, but it was always there. And so we just have to realize that God it's just part of the plan. We don't understand the plan sometimes, but God has the plan. And as we get more and more in tune to these festivals, we will understand the plan even better year after year after year. So with that, I think that's it. Yeah, that's all I had. And I wanted to leave some time here for questions. Also, if you would like any more information on the Beit HaShuavah, which we will be doing on Tuesday night, then I'd be glad to answer those too. Anybody? Yes, ma'am.
For easiest question of the day, ESV, I'm not familiar with that.
That's the English Standard Version of the Bible.
English
Standard Version. It's I like that version. It seems to be a little bit more clear. That's next to the New King James Version. New King James Version takes Old English and changes it into New English. The ESV sort of does a little bit better job, I think, in making that clear. If you're used to using the King James Version, the New King James Version is probably the better one for you. But ESV, I like that a little bit better still. Any other questions? Okay, my purpose here is to make you into all veterans. Have I done that? Do you understand where we're coming from? All right, so, yes, David.
It's not a question, it is a comment.
Okay. Well, appreciate that. A lot of people think I'm very controlling, and I am. When you got 50 guys working for you, you've got to be somewhat controlling. But also, I'm a type of person. I'm very organizational minded. One of the things I did learn in my former church organization was to be organizationally minded. I can set up chairs and make them absolutely perfectly straight. That's how organized I am. But it's organization helps everybody out because, you know, you guys wouldn't want to come here and me not show up. And I don't want to take and put a presentation together and you all come 15 minutes late. So, you know, as long as we all try to work together, stay on schedule, and if, you know, we're going to try to do what we say we're going to do, and we want you to do what you say you're going to do. And as long as we do all that, everybody should be pretty much harmonious in everything, right? So we try to keep the organization, you know, we try to be as free in the organization as possible, but yet there's things that do have to get done. And because you're expecting certain things from us, and we want to deliver them to you. We want you to, when you leave here, feel like that you've come to some place, you haven't just wasted 8 days, that you've benefited from this. And that you're going to want to go home and tell your friends that this is something where you're going to come and you're going to learn something. You're going to have your children are going to have a great time, and you know, you're going to learn, you're going to meet new people and all that. That's the whole purpose behind this. And it's very difficult on the leadership end to try to get all of our minds thinking together, because each of us have different viewpoints on how things should be done, but we do come to agreement, and once we do come to agreement, we move forward in agreement on those. I would say it's not a consensus, it's just an agreement that we all agreed to do it this way. So even though I may not like it, we're going to do it this way. I'll give you an example. The schedule we're following this year, I didn't like it, but I got overruled. So because I listened to the other guys, and I said, okay guys, what do y'all think? They said, we like it. And I said, okay, well, we'll do it then. So that's the way it worked. Right. What we're doing this year, just for those of you who've been here before, I got a call from the camp here early in the spring, and they said that they would like to know if we could move our morning sessions up 1 hour. And, of course, that would put the Deuteronomy reading at about 7 o'clock in the morning. Or 7:25, and I said, no, I don't think we can do that. And they said, well, our kitchen staff, we're having to keep our kitchen staff an extra hour and a half every day to accommodate you guys. And sometimes there might be 30 of you, but sometimes there's only 10, but we have to keep the whole staff. So could you not try to do something to where that will free our staff up? And so I started penciling out different schedules and all of that, and I came up with what we've got right now. Which what it did is it by moving the breakout sessions, many of them in the morning, that got us out of, you know, freed us up about an hour earlier. So that's why we're doing it. I just told Angie this morning, I said one of the drawbacks of the schedule is now I have to change twice in a day, because I don't like to wear nice clothes during a breakout session, so I like to wear jeans. But I don't like to teach down there or be down there wearing jeans, so I have to put something nice on. And then I have to take it back off that afternoon and get back into my jeans, you know. But that's just one of the drawbacks of it. Yes, ma'am.
Do you have any suggestions for finding other people of this belief to meet with? We have a congregation of one.
Right? I'm sorry?
We have a congregation of one.
Right? Really? Yeah, I understand. That's one of the good things about being here is that there are people from all over the country. You are from Arizona?
Yes.
Well, you know, there's a lot of Arizona folks here.
I
Now, where's Yuma, though?
It's southwest corner.
Well, nobody even wants to go down there.
You should see us in the wintertime,
though. We don't have a resource for that. Eddie Chumney, for a long time, had a resource on his website for that. But that's one of the reasons why we do put your name, I mean your city, on our on the name tags, is so people can see where you are from. It's a very difficult thing, you know, to find these people, but you'd be surprised how many times there's someone just down the road from you that is walking this way or beginning to walk this way, because this is a massively growing movement, what did I call it before, awakening. This is growing really, really fast, and so there's probably someone in the area. Angie and I, what we did for about a year is we put little short Torah studies in our newspaper. And it was just a little, maybe about that long, maybe 200 words. And it cost us about $30 a week, $30, $40 a week to do it. But we were getting calls from that. Just people saying, why are you putting the Bible? Or why are you putting that old law in there? And then they would say old law because they didn't want to give away to the fact that they're starting to study that old law. And then they would call us and say, well, what do y'all do? And then, you know, the conversation would go on. But, you know, I don't know of anybody right now who's got a big clearinghouse for that other than MIA. Now, MIA, you can become a way station or something for them and get your name listed as a congregation, too. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. I don't think it's ever going to get to where there's big crystal cathedral messianic groups or Hebraic groups. Right, yeah. There's going to be a little bit here, a little bit there in this thing. Yeah, I think so too. Yes, ma'am. We're planning to have it here as long as they'll let us. And if we'll stay off the grass, then it may be a long time, because they really do like us. They really do. We don't pay them anything if we fill the rooms up. And so as long as people are coming and filling the rooms up, then they're tickled to death to have us here. We don't have to pay them anything. It costs anywhere from $20,000 to $25,000 a year to put this on. And so... And that's because of just all the little costs. They just add up so quickly. A bulb for one of these things here costs $500. So, I don't know if you noticed, I about broke this one the other day. I tripped on the cable. But you just have all these costs, and so it does cost quite a bit. We had one person email me and ask me what an appropriate contribution would be. I wrote them back and I said, it cost about $20,000 to $25,000 to do this. There's going to be about 700, or at that time, about 600 people here. Do the math. You know.
How many people are actually
here? I don't know how many are actually here. Every year, about 5 to 10% of the people don't show. But there again, with about 5 to 10% of the people will not register with us. For some reason, they simply will not register. I see them every year, but they never will register, but they're always here. I don't. Maybe they're conspiracy theorists or something like that. I don't know. But, sir, go ahead, David.
Passage in Numbers in here? Numbers 29 has the...
In Numbers 29, let me see. Yeah, it's down here in if you look down through here in, let me see, on the 15th. Okay, you look at verse 14. No, I'm sorry, that's not it. Okay, verse 16 says, and one male goat for a sin offering besides the continual burnt offering, its grain offering, and its drink offering. Okay? If you look up, and there's a number of other passages that have that word drink offering, you'll see those words spelled three different ways. The words drink offering, I forget what the Hebrew word is for it, but you'll see that spelled three different ways. In the first one, they have an added mem, That's an M for us. They have an added M, a mem. The next one will have an added yod, or yud, as Bill Cloud says it. And then the third one will have another added mem. So they take those three letters, mem, yod, mem, which spells mayim, water. And they say, okay, during the festival, God's telling us something in between the lines that we're supposed to do something with water. And so they came up with this. And this is the basis of a lot of Hebrew thought. You know, how many of you are simply new to the Hebraic movement? Okay, a lot of you are then. Okay. I got three or four more minutes. In the Hebraic thought, every word, every letter, every dagish, which is a point that gives you the strength of the letter, every little decoration on the letter, and even the spaces between the letters means something. They believe that God put everything in there in an exact way to tell us something. There's not. I've come to see that there is no wasted words in the Bible, and that there's no stories that are told simply for illustrating a thought. The stories that were told were all prophecies. I mean, this right here, I'm sorry, this passage back here, I should have put the whole passage up. That's not just nice flowing flowery words. That's a prophecy. And so God doesn't waste anything. And the Jewish people understand that. So, and you know, they know this Bible better than we ever did. In fact, the Jewish people know the New Testament better than we ever did. Okay? And because they look at it with a Hebraic background. They can look in there and they'll say, say John says, and Yeshua did this, and Yeshua did that, and Yeshua did this, and. They say, who? That's Hebrew. Because that's a Hebrew characteristic of putting ands in your Bible. If you look at any practically every passage in the Torah will lead off with a vav, which in Hebrew indicates an and. It's a connecting. So that's how God connects thoughts together. So they can look at these things with a Hebraic background, a Middle Eastern background, as Rico was talking about yesterday, and see things in there that we never saw. And so that's why Dr. John and I, John Merritt and I, are going to be sharing a breakout session. We're going to be going over this passage. This passage goes on, and it stops somewhere around John 53. And then there's a whole change of thought there for about 10 verses. And we're going to be talking about those 10 verses in our breakout session. But as you get more Hebraically thinking, you can start to see some of this stuff. And the Jewish people have done so. So that's why we want to soak the brains of the Jews. You know, we want to find out what they're thinking about these things. That's why I got in trouble yesterday by calling this a Mishnah. But you know, Mishnah is just the code of, you know, it's the Jewish code of halakha, you might say, the way you walk. And so this is our little halakha for the year. But we want to understand their halakha. We may not want to participate in their halakha, but we need to understand their halakha. And so please be not anti-Jewish. Just want to learn from... Yes, ma'am.
I just have a quick question about your comment. This changes the subject totally, but okay. We're running out of time. Do you meet in homes in your congregation back where you come from?
No, ma'am. We did meet in homes for a long time. But about 6 years ago, I found a place that we can meet for $25 a week. And it's a little small meeting room about yay big right here. Plus, it has a kitchen. Plus, it has bathrooms that are separate. So for our group of about 20, 25 people, it works good. Now, Yom Kippur, we had about 45 people in there, and it's a little bit tight. Everybody comes out for Yom Kippur. So anyway, that's how we do it. We do that because we want everybody to feel on equal ground. When they come into my home, they're a little bit uneasy. Plus, new people, if you're starting a congregation, if you've got a congregation and you're wanting people to come, they're more likely to come to a neutral spot than going into somebody's home. They can't leave your home if they don't like what you're saying, where they can leave the threshold. The threshold. So, all right, that's all I've got. Be glad to talk to you individually, but I got to get out of here and make room for the next guy. So appreciate your attendance, and I hope you become all veterans now. You what?
I learned a lot.
Well, good deal.
I'm starting from ground zero.
Well, it's a slow walk, and a slow understanding growth mess. Don't have to jump into everything one time.
I'm hoping by the end of the week I have something to take home to my family, because right now I'm kind of in a fog.
Yeah, yeah. Well, Rico presented a lot yesterday, and of course Lee tried to give a very good balanced understanding to get started on and stuff, so. Okay, I think Rico is in here. No, Rico's upstairs, so I gotta take this upstairs.
Is that upstairs?
Yes, Rico's upstairs.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I don't think that one's upstairs.